This is ILTA Radio, the source for legal technology practices and ideas to help your career delivered to fit your busy schedule. ILTA Radio, get tuned in.
Welcome, ILTA members, to today's podcast. My name is Sean Conlon. I'm a business development manager with Consilio. Today with me is my colleague, Rob Fried. He is a senior director at Consilio in the forensics department. We will be covering a number of topics around the question, do you truly own your own data? The topics we will be covering are the changes in hardware, what can be recovered from newer devices, the changes in software, what can you assess and collect, and the evolution of data storage. Question one, over the course of the time, Rob, data storage devices have evolved. What can be recovered from the new storage devices compared to the older storage devices?
I think it's a great question, Sean. And, you know, to think about how this has all evolved, I've been doing forensics since 2002 professionally. I've been studying it since 1998. I actually took my first forensic science classes around 1995. So I've seen it all in my course of doing this work. I can say that when we initially started doing data collections, it was pretty well defined. We'd have a certain set of data that we would go after. So we may have to go after hard drives, network data, email, of course. And now we're seeing a major progression into smaller form factor devices. We're all holding iPhones in our hands, and we're all holding tablets and using devices that are just so able to be hidden in our pockets that when you think about the days of the older machines, you know, they were clunkers. They were large machines, and we would have to have enough space on our floors and on, you know, in our desk areas to accommodate them. So the technology has advanced and progressed from IDE, which were the ribbon types of devices that, you know, had pins on the back of them, to SATA drives, which were more efficient. You know, they didn't actually have the physical moving parts anymore. They are now accommodating flash memory, to now even mSATA, which almost looks like a RAM stick when you look at the drive. So they went from a very robust type of form factor to now being very small and holding the same amount of data. And you know, although the technology has become more efficient, you know, some things to consider is just there could be a sudden loss of data with those devices if they're not handled correctly or just through their normal usage. They have a lifespan as well. But something to note about the flash memory and SSD, which is the newer technology that's out there, solid state drives, is that these new drives have what's known as trim that can be enabled on them. And what that allows us to do is operate more efficiently in the sense that when you delete a file, sectors, you know, are immediately cleared on the media. And although that allows us to access our data more efficiently and be able to do things quicker, the recovery of that data may not be possible, may be limited. There is an option to disable trim support, but it's not typically a default. Most devices, let's say Apple devices, you order a device right now from Apple, it will have a SSD solid state drive contained within, and it's going to be trim enabled, and then you may want to recover data down the road for an investigation, and that may not be possible. So although we see the enhanced performance on these drives, that challenge is definitely there. And, you know, when we were talking before and I said that I've seen a lot of these technologies shift over time, when we initially did these data collections, the IDE drives would have so many different adapters and things like that that we'd bring to the table with us to do the work. You know, sometimes we can't even remove the mSATA drives now. They're basically part of the motherboard. And, you know, that's something to take into consideration. We have to think about our approach and how we're going to access these new drives, and we may need to do a bootable type of forensic image process where we boot the machine that has the drive contained within, and then we run through the imaging process that way. So although we physically can't remove the hard drive, we still have a method.
You talk about the enhancements and the progress that it's made over the years, and in quite such a quick time, it seems like. I remember personally when I was in college 15 years ago, I was one of the only kids in the dorm with a flat screen, and that flat screen is no longer a flat screen anymore. It's a brick. My computer's thinner than the screen I had 15 years ago. So it's the enhancements are recognized not only from a storage and physical device, but also in the performance, like you say.
Absolutely. And it's just amazing to see that transition. And to be honest with you, in such a short period of time in reality, where now everything that we're seeing, you know, shifting from being something that's taking up space, right? I mean, I look at, you mentioned those monitors. I look at the curb sometimes, you know, as I'm just driving down the street and people are literally putting those on the curb, the CRT monitors, the LCD screens now, even the flat screens that we see people buying in the homes, because it's just, you know, there's so many enhancements. I mean, my father's trying to give me one of his flat screens at home that's relatively new. It's just he likes the new technology that has all the built-in apps. So our technology is getting so much more advanced, and we just have to stay on top of it and realize that it's really important for us to be, as practitioners, on top of all the different trends that are out there and how we need to do our jobs and collect and preserve and then potentially examine this data. So something interesting that I wanted to raise also is there's a lot of these other types of media that's out there, specifically the encrypted keypad drives. And so the interesting thing about them is that, you know, we've used encryption for years on our target media and, you know, just in general media that our custodians are having us preserve. And, you know, we've seen it where there's containers that are out there. So we would actually create an encrypted container on storage media, or our data custodians would give us media like this. And it would be something that we would have to actually address and get the encryption password. Now there are keypad drives that actually have combinations on the physical drives. And the challenge with them is that they're no longer just thumb drives that get handed to us. They're protected. And so, you know, we have to ask for that information. There's also BitLocker enabled media that's out there. And so encryption's playing a big role in all this. And, you know, fortunately for us in the private sector, our clients, you know, work with us, our data custodians work with us to provide us access, because the main thing is we need access to the data to decrypt the drive in order to gain access to the data. We need access to the data, right? So we need that information. Our law enforcement friends sometimes encounter this, and the person that's there trying to get information out of doesn't provide this information. So it really becomes a challenge. There are obviously concerns about it, but this technology is now available. It's readily available on different sites that you can go and purchase, like Amazon and whatnot. So it's more prevalent, and it's just something to make everyone aware of, that you're going to start seeing, you know, the efficient drives, like we talked about, the MStata flash memory, but you're also going to see encrypted keypad drives. So just something to be aware of out there in the market and just in general, where people are using it more and more.
Hey, Rob, what have you ever had a client or someone come to you that has forgot the code to a drive or the encryption? And if so, what are you able to do? Are you able to access it? Are there workarounds? Are there security experts that could, say, hack into something like that?
Well, the technology is very, very good, and, you know, the protection is very good. And I would say that, you know, there's some options available, You know, we have a couple ways where we can see if decryption keys are stored either on a computer, or IT professionals may have it where they provide that to us. There are also outfits out there that specialize in decryption if it's no longer available, or it's, you know, somebody had passed away, or it's just not known. So there are potential ways, but I will say that, you know, that's something that if you do forget, you know, it's just some effort needs to be put in there to see what options are available. And, you know, there's potentially, you know, no guarantee to it as well, depending on the capabilities of the specialist that you go to.
Yep. Very good.
Okay, well, moving on, I would like to talk about cloud-based storage. I live here in Seattle. Two of the biggest storage providers, Amazon, AWS, and Microsoft with Azure. So they, you know, they are providing services to store data, whether it be on my computer or phone. Can you tell us a little bit about these services and, you know, whether, you know, what the difference is of storing the data either on my phone or with a service, like I mentioned?
Yeah, so what you're talking about is really cloud-based storage solutions, and they're becoming more and more prevalent. People want to have access to their data from anywhere. Everybody walks around with these tablets, right? These cell phones. And, you know, if you want access to your data, there's a couple different ways to do it, but these cloud storage solutions really give you the ability to access your data from anywhere as long as you're online. And what's amazing about it is where we talked about before, you know, these desktop computers and having to kind of be in front of your machine in order to gain access to the data, you're no longer confined to four walls, right? I mean, if you think about it, your data's literally anywhere that you are. And what that means is when you're using these storage solutions, you know, you almost lose a little bit of control of your data, right? So although you have your own account and it's something that you log into, these storage solutions, you know, require you to kind of interact with them in order for you to, you know, log in and read or export the data. So in reality, it's not data that's sitting in front of you anymore. You're accessing a service, and you really have to rely on that service being online, having that data available to you, and all the security parameters that they're using. But there's a lot of options. There's Dropbox, there's iCloud, there's Box.com. You know, there's a lot of these services out there that are just growing each and every day, you know, in terms of what they're providing their clientele and their users. And so when you think about the different solutions that we're seeing more on the e-discovery side of things, we're talking about O365. So now your data, you know, is kind of, you know, being managed by Microsoft or Google Drive. Now Google Drive has access, you know, to your data or storing your data. And so these other solutions that are out there, they're no longer sitting on your hard drive. They're actually out on their particular storage media. And, you know, your ability to, like I said, gain access to them, you know, is somewhat different now. So a lot of companies have switched over to these particular models. And, you know, in a lot of our interactions, we're seeing a lot of custodians using services like Dropbox or Box.com or iCloud. And what's interesting is, you know, when you ask these companies whether or not they permit it, some do, some don't, right? So it's something that we're seeing become more and more prevalent now. These service providers, they offer different subscription models that could be anywhere from gigabytes to terabytes worth of space. I know that I personally have a Dropbox account with 2 terabytes worth of storage. That's a astronomical amount of storage, but I do have a lot of materials over the course of years that I've, you know, accumulated on my computers. And so everything is now accessible to me. Collecting from that data, preserving that data would be very interesting to think about, because it, you know, when you're talking about collecting from a terabyte hard drive, that takes time. Now talking about collecting from a terabyte cloud service, that's going to take even more time. So you really have to set some expectations with the clients about, you know, how accessible the data is, number one, how much time it's going to take. Some of these providers, they throttle the downloads, which means that they're only going to restrict you to a certain number of let's say gigabytes per day for you to go in and export from these services. But there are some particular companies out there that, you know, understanding some of these complexities and challenges, they know that certain times you need more efficient, faster access to your data. So they basically have a solution, a service that allows them to offer to people a more direct pipe into these services, which allows companies to download or export the data quicker. And that becomes a challenge for a lot of people because, you know, there are always deadlines in e-discovery. And if you have a vendor or solution that allows you to gain access to this quicker, you're going to be a lot better off than just kind of allowing it to go through its normal course, maybe getting throttled along the way and just monitoring it. But just something to think about is that these cloud solutions are great. They allow access from anywhere. They're allowing us to basically work more efficiently. But the challenges from the e-discovery side of things is that it's possible, you know, that there are some potential challenges, obstacles that need to be overcome. And the courts need to understand that. The council needs to understand it, that we're at the mercy of these service providers. And we need to understand, you know, where all the data is located, how accessible it is, and what information we need from the data custodian or from the clients that we have to get access to it.
2 terabyte Dropbox account, Rob, that's a lot of photos, bud.
Yeah, it's a lot of photos. It's a lot of documents. You know, just think about how the size of hard drives have transitioned over the years and have increased over the years. And, you know, as you're backing up these files, think about the potential, like you said before, suddenly losing your solid state drive. It just basically, you know, it dies on you. And you know, if you don't have that backed up and you have trim enabled, the ability to recover, even, you know, for myself is potentially not going to be there. So it's important to have access to all your data, back it up, and potentially use these services for that they can provide.
Well, that's a good segue into the next topic. With the evolution of the data storages, the various softwares that we can store this data in, and the amount of data we're creating and data that's out there, how has it affected the way you collect from these devices?
Yeah, that's a great question. Fundamentally, you know, when you talk about data collections, you know, you have to have an approach that's defensible and efficient. And what does defensible means? It means that you're using forensically sound tools and methodologies to perform this process with the ultimate goal of allowing the evidence to be admitted in a court of law if necessary, right? So that's a fundamental consideration of data collections. You also want to have your process be very efficient, because it's important to never lose sight that, you know, there's a potential business involved, or there's somebody who needs to have a lot, you know, their livelihood may be impacted. So we just want to ensure business continuity when we're doing these processes, especially if we're working into a large organization, or, you know, just being aware of the convenience factor that comes into play for people. You know, if we're going to do data collections, we may want to do them later in the day, towards the evening when people are leaving for the day. So we think about all these things. But defensibility, I think, is really important as well, because we want to make sure that whatever we do, whatever methodologies we do, they're defensible and the court's going to accept the data collection. But in reality, it's just been a cat and mouse game a lot of times, just keeping up with all the different data sources that are out there, all the changes that are occurring almost on a daily basis. what you may see today, where you may have access and be able to collect it, you may not be able to collect it tomorrow. There's constant shifting of programming, underlying programming to these services, and just all these changes that are occurring to make people's experience, enhance people's experience, enhance security, et cetera, et cetera. And it's really important to have a good amount of tools in your toolkit that are validated, meaning that, you know, you've taken the time to test your tools to make sure they're doing what they're expected to be doing. And each and every member of a forensic team should be validating their own tools, their tools as they're going to use them. That's really important for a number of reasons. For number one, we need to understand if the source that we are collecting from can be collected from multiple tools. Sometimes tools, you know, may support one device, but they're not going to support another device. And also to cross-validate. Sometimes tools parse information differently. So what you may see on one tool is not available or is not showing up for whatever reason on another tool. And so we have this constant need to just make sure that we're validating, you know, we're ensuring that we're seeing as much data as we can possibly see to provide the best results to our clients. But I think it's important to really understand that, you know, you should have a good understanding of what's going on underneath the hood of your tools that you're using. You need to have experience with the tools, right? So you need to understand what the tool can and can't do. It would be a great thing to look into whether or not that tool has any professional certifications and attain them if possible. And a lot of tools offer this. And it's really important to have good rapport with the people that actually, you know, create these tools, and they have a lot of technical support that comes along with them, and great technical support, and just having good rapport allows somebody to, an examiner, to not only know what they can and can't do possibly, but what's next. You know, how is that particular vendor addressing some changes, you know, with regards to the devices, or, you know, what's the outlook? What's the support going to look like down the road as, you know, the technology advances? And just staying in good terms with everybody. It's a very small community, and we're all here to help each other out. And I've seen some great support from our software vendors.
You talk about, you know, having an understanding of the tool and experience with it. How does your team at Consilio vet these tools? I mean, people have to be updating and developing. We want to be strategic to make sure we're getting the right tool for the right job. But how do you vet this? How do you test these tools? Or what does that process look like?
So if you've done a lab experiment in science class, it's very similar. You go through a set series of steps. So, you know, if I was to, let's say, image a hard drive, I'm going to hook it up to a write blocker, and I'm going to use that imaging tool to capture a forensic image of that hard drive, every sector of that hard drive. And I'm going to look to see, you know, and dive deep into that to make sure that all the different areas of the hard drive were preserved. And so there's a set of steps that I would take. And there's a lot of organizations out there like NIST and others that, you know, are doing their own testing. But, you know, we do some deep dives into some of these tools when we first get them to make sure that what we expect is actually what is actually returning from these devices. So, for example, you know, if we think about every sector on a hard drive, you know, we're going to go and look at each and every sector of that hard drive to see if there's data in there that the number of sectors reported for that particular hard drive is the number of sectors that are copied and there's data in there. So there's processes that we take. There's a set of steps, and, you know, we just work very closely with a lot of these vendors too, to try to get potentially beta versions of the software, or if a new version comes out, we will actually test it before we roll it out on our particular forensic examination machines. So we don't just take a brand new version and run with it. We definitely have a team in-house that, you know, evaluates the software, stays on top of that. We have a whole initiative on our team, for example. And then when a new version comes out, we distribute the release notes, we do the testing, and then we encourage other people to do the testing as well. And then we make a decision on rolling that out to the larger hardware and equipment that we use.
Very cool. So it's not a shot in the dark, it sounds like.
No. And we definitely don't want to, you know, use software until we're comfortable with it. There could be bugs. There could be things that are going on with the software that you just are not sure of. And if you bring that into a live environment, obviously, where you may have some evidence involved, that's not a good thing. So we obviously take steps to make sure that we are looking at our software and making the right decision for the team and for our client. One thing that I want to really highlight here, Sean, that I think is really important with any of this is that, you know, there's only potentially one chance, one shot to get to the data, to preserve the data, right? People's time, and you get involved in a lot of the conversations on scheduling and logistics and all the different things that go on in the background to make this happen. And it's really important to realize that, you know, people's time is valuable. You want to have a very set process before you go in to these situations, because, you know, if you're not bringing the right tool or you're not thinking through the process, you may not be able to preserve the data, and that becomes a challenge. So some of the things that I think that are important are, you know, just preparing yourself and having the team know in a way what they may expect. And if they encounter something unexpected, okay, we can definitely work through that, but just be prepared, because you may only have one shot, you know, to get this.
So when it comes to collecting and going on site or doing a remote collection, what type of questions does someone need to ask prior to collecting the data? Is there anything that is there a talk track, or are there a list of questions that you like to have answered before going and collecting from, say, a computer or a mobile device?
Yeah, I think, you know, there's definitely questions of the make, the model, the operating system, you know, any specific applications or data that you're particularly interested in or may be relevant to your case. That's really important. And we spoke about having good rapport with the vendors. And so if, let's say, for example, there's a cell phone that needs to be collected, we're going to ask for that make and model and the operating system and the app version, because the forensic tool, you know, may or may not support it. And we want to know that going in. So because things are shifting every day, think about the fact of, you know, let's say the iOS, the updates, how many updates you've had to apply to your phone, or the number of versions of an app that may be updating in the background. You may not even know it, but, you know, there may be apps that are updating in the background on your phone, and going to collect that may become a challenge, because now that app version is not supported by your tool. The situation can be avoided if you have these conversations with your clients and with your data custodians ahead of time, versus going in and just saying, oh, I've got an iPhone and I just want to do a collection. Well, let's figure out kind of where we're at in terms of the operating system for that phone and the app. And sometimes we encounter people that once the collection is scheduled, they, you know, have an automatic update happening on their phones, and that actually hinders our ability to collect. So it may be even something that even after we have the conversation that happens, and then, you know, it becomes a little bit of an obstacle for us in the background. Something that's also particularly interesting, you know, with phones is your ability to recover, you know, deleted messages, and whether or not that's relevant to your case. That the ability to recover text messages may be dependent on your tool's ability to parse out the messages from the database, right? So there's a whole bunch of different databases where the data from a phone is stored. And so if the tool, you know, is able to grab it out of the databases, it will. If not, then it's not going to be recoverable. But we think about whether or not there's any backups, right? I mean, think about the iTunes backups that are on computers where people are plugging in their phones. And now you have the ability to get information from the computer that may not be on the physical phone anymore. So backups can be potentially useful. And then, you know, something to consider also, if text messages are really important and, you know, you're using an app that deals with now ephemeral messaging, that message may only be available for a temporary period of time. So your ability to potentially preserve it is a little bit limited. A lot of companies may start seeing a lot more companies using text messaging or allowing it. And some of these apps that are out there, you know, have limited lifespans in terms of their messaging. And so companies need to be aware of some of these challenges with these apps. And then, you know, also address it with their employees, that if they are seeing employees that are using different apps that, you know, have these little challenges and obstacles with them, they need to address it, because, you know, there could be compliance issues or potentially sanctions if the data is no longer available and, you know, these messaging apps were being used for business transactions and whatnot. Some other considerations that I think are really relevant here, just, and this can apply to a computer, like you had mentioned before, is encryption. You know, so if we encounter a device that has encryption, we need to work with the data custodian or the IT administrators to gain access to the device, the data on the device. Passwords may be relevant to ask for as well. And so we work with our counsel, you know, as well as the custodian and IT personnel to obtain any passwords from data custodians. And getting into accounts itself. So let's say, for example, you know, we need to collect from different types of cloud services like we talked about, and other types of sources like email, for example, we need account credentials to gain access to that data. So we have to work directly with either the data custodian or the client IT contact. And that's also important. And another thing that also comes up very frequently is two-factor authentication, where, you know, in order to access the account, you log in and then it sends a code to a device. And then we need that code in order to access the account. So these are important considerations when doing these collections.
Very good. When it comes to how data usage has evolved over time, how has that affected the custodial interaction when discussing data and collections? So, you know, you have some clients or custodians say you need to collect from their cell phone. There's a lot of private information on there, or stuff not pertinent to a matter or their work life. How does that interaction take place? How do you usually handle those situations?
Yeah, with BYOD, bring your own device, you know, scenarios where companies are allowing their employees to actually bring their devices into the workplace and onto the network. You know, there's a lot of sensitivities there. There's obviously the benefit of having one phone, right? So I personally carry two phones with me. I have a work phone and I have a personal phone. You know, there's sensitivities with the commingling of business and personal data, for sure. And we encounter that. And we let people know that, you know, we capture the entire device just as part of the preservation effort. But, you know, we're only going to extract out the data that's relevant, and we're not going to look at the other data. It's going to be filtered down, however, which way we need to do that. You know, and we put everything on encrypted media and to protect the security and the sensitivity of the information. But it's definitely something that's coming up more and more. There's, you know, a lot of organizations that are, you know, using BYOD or implementing it within the organization. Others are starting to pull back from it because they realize that this sensitivity is a tough conversation, you know, with their employees. And so it's something that we're aware of and we encounter pretty frequently, and we definitely have some workflows around that. Just think about how many devices that we all use these days and how everything is connected up to the internet. It's all, you know, potentially online. And it's really important to understand where the data that may be relevant is located and how to preserve it, again, in the most defensible and efficient manner. And so we have to work closely with IT contacts, with legal, you know, teams, both internally and outside counsel, the key stakeholders of a business practice, and also participate in custodial interviews, data custodial interviews. There's been more and more of a need to do that, more so now than ever before. Because like when we first started talking today, we talked about, you know, the evolution of hard drives, of, you know, just having data in front of you to now being in the cloud, right? And so what the IT team may know or may think, you know, where data is located may be different than what a data custodian knows to be where the data is collected. That there may be two different, maybe different locations, unknown locations. And so it's important to be really engaged in those conversations and contribute where necessary. The evolution of data has also brought up interesting topics of all these new solutions that are out there and how people are interacting. There are organizations that use solutions like Slack more than they use email. So, you know, in a given scenario where you may see gaps of people not using email or very limited use, they may have an overwhelming usage of another platform. And a lot of these solutions that are coming out are out there now, they have, you know, several ways to upload data, right? You think about how many ways you can get data onto these different platforms. The one thing that sometimes isn't thought about is, well, how do you get data out? We talked about data that's in the cloud. So if you're using a solution that's in the cloud and it's not on your premise, it's not, you know, on premise, you need to log in, you need to figure out the export process. You know, you're not in full control of your data anymore, like we discussed. And so that becomes a challenge. And then maybe your ability to export is based on your subscription model. So maybe if you have a free account or a business account that's a standard and it's not, you know, let's say a plus account, there's going to be different options for you. And how's the metadata, right? The data about data impacted as you do your exports from these different solutions. Things are really starting to increase in terms of these solutions, and we have to take these considerations to heart and to start thinking through them, being not only just aware of them, but thinking through, well, what if, you know, we're subject to litigation? What if we do need to export that out? You know, what's the next step for us in being able to do that? And that's where we come in. And so, you know, think about also social media. You know, people use LinkedIn, they use Facebook, they use Instagram, you name it. All these different platforms that are out there. What data is out there? Is it relevant to your case? And how are we going to preserve this data to allow it, again, to bring it into a courtroom if necessary, as, you know, evidence being accepted as evidence in that courtroom? That's really, really important. That's a fundamental part of it. With social media, what you potentially will see publicly is different than if you were given credentials to log into somebody's private account. And all these things are really important when you're thinking about somebody's got a Facebook account. You know, what I'm able to navigate to and see is different than if, you know, Joe Smith gave me his credentials and I logged into his account and I saw it and I took the information and preserved it. And that's really important stuff to consider as well. It's really important to practice smart lawyering. And what that means, and a good friend and colleague of mine, Dave Grant, said this, that this is a really important topic, and I fully agree with him, and I love the terminology here. And, you know, what it really comes down to is there's so much evolution of technology these days that it's really important to bring in an expert. You know, you understand the legal aspect of things. You may not fully grasp the technology. There are experts like myself, like my colleagues, that do this work on a daily basis. And it's important to get us involved. We stay on top of the trends. We stay on top of the tools. And we're here to help. And I think that that's really important to acknowledge. And we're always available to be your trusted advisor and really see the success of your project, and also just make sure that we establish good rapport with one another whenever there's a challenging situation, that we're here and available to step you through the process and advise accordingly.
Well, thanks for that, Rob. I think it's a very interesting topic and pertinent topic in today's day and age. And, you know, all the data we're creating, how do we get to that data? Those important data, you know, being smart attorneys or legal teams, making sure that to partner with the appropriate people. You know, we'd like to thank ILTA for hosting us. And just to close, you know, Consilio has over 30 plus team members around the world that are up to date with their certifications. We have state-of-the-art technologies that can get in and collect the data for you and support you in the manner that you deem necessary. So thank you again, ILTA, for having us.
You've been listening to ILTA Radio. Subscribe to ILTA's podcasts through iTunes or Podbean and get alerted about new recordings. ILTA Radio, get tuned in.